So good evening. I'm delighted that so many of you have joined us for the Athenaeum Symposium on Paul Cray, which will, of course, continue tomorrow. He is a great and, I think, still underappreciated architect. And, of course, we're delighted that you've joined, so many of you have joined us for this keynote address. Speaking on behalf of the staff and trustees of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, we are delighted to be able to support this important initiative and to work collaboratively with our colleagues at the Athenaeum. We very much value this relationship. Nearly 7 years ago, we assessed the condition of the Rodin Museum and the collection it houses, and decided that a number of changes were needed. As I studied this problem and considered how we could improve the museum and the presentation of its collection, it offered me an opportunity to take a close look at the building, which was designed, of course, by Paul Cray and opened to the public first in 1930. Through that process, I came to appreciate the sophistication of Cray as an architect, and today I feel even more strongly about this. So go see for yourself. The Rodin Museum is a gem, a superb example of both his skill as a designer and his understanding of the classical tradition. Cray's work is worth careful study, and I'm delighted that the symposium organized by the Athenaeum will give us an opportunity to do so. We're delighted, of course, to welcome this evening's speaker back to Philadelphia. He's been here many, many times. Paul Goldberg, as all of you know, I think is a man of many parts and many accomplishments, but above all, a great writer on the subject of architecture, both historic and contemporary. He's presently a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and holds the Joseph Urban Chair in Design and Architecture at the New School in New York City, which in the late 1920s commissioned Urban to design what turned out to be, in my view, one of his finest buildings. But Mr. Goldberger is perhaps best known for having served as the architectural critic of the New York Times from 1973 to 1997, a remarkable run, when he succeeded Brendan Gill as the architecture critic of the New Yorker and writer of the celebrated column titled The Skyline, an affiliation that lasted until 2011. As a young architectural historian and curator, I read Mr. Goldberger's work avidly for a very long time, always with a mixture of respect and often, I should add, with a bit of envy. At his range, his fluency, and the spirit of openness and curiosity that has always characterized his writing. He came of age as a journalist at a time when architecture seemed to matter a lot. And the controversies of the day, whites versus grays, the fate of urbanism, or the reassessment of the modern movement, a particularly brutal thing to watch, to name just a few, generated a great deal of passion and inspired some very fine journalism. He embraced all of that and much more with enthusiasm and a sense of perspective that I still find both admirable and refreshing. Looking back over the course of a career that has spanned nearly five decades, what remains most striking about Goldberger's writing is its range. He's always maintained a sharp focus on the present and the work of emerging architects and new ideas in the field, while also, just as importantly, looking back to the past when the lessons to be drawn from it seem particularly germane. Like his appreciation of Daniel Burnham's Plan of Chicago, which on the occasion of the 100th anniversary, Goldberger called, quote, the most effective example of large-scale planning America has ever seen. His writing is equally striking for its clarity and accessibility, both of which are cardinal virtues in my book. At a time when it increasingly seems that insiders write for other insiders, Paul Goldberger's prose has never condescended to the reader, but rather invites him to be a fellow traveler and feel right at home. He always manages to explain complex ideas in a straightforward way, no easy task, and is fond of digressions, but never loses sight of the main point. Best of all, he has always a good story to tell and knows how to bring that story to life. Plus, he admires the work of Frank Gehry, the subject of his most recent book. And for those of us who work at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, that's a very, very good thing. So please join me in welcoming Paul Goldberger to the podium.
Thank you so much. That is possibly the kindest introduction I've ever received, and I'm deeply grateful for its thoughtfulness, as well as for the plug for the Frank Gehry book, of course. which is good for me and good for the museum. It's a special honor, as well as a great pleasure, to be here to celebrate one of the great achievements in urban design, not only in Philadelphia, but really all across the United States. I'll say something in a few minutes about what it and the City Beautiful movement that it represents might mean for the city today. But let me start with a couple of thoughts about the Parkway itself. There really is nothing else quite like the Benjamin Franklin Parkway anywhere in the United States. It's worth marking its centennial. Indeed, it's worth celebrating every day, since no city, not even Chicago under Daniel Burnham, or San Francisco with its Civic Center by Arthur Baker, managed to do quite what Philadelphia did a century ago. Philadelphia's ability to translate French notions of architecture and planning into meaningful 20th century presences within a colonial American city seems, when you think about it, rather astonishing, even awe-inspiring, and not only because of its great scope and ambition. It is astonishing because there is something about it that is a bit incomprehensible, maybe even bizarre, in the way it appears to be completely out of character for Philadelphia, completely disconnected from the city's prior planning history. After all, this is the city of William Penn, the city laid out with Penn's four squares punctuating a tight grid, a city that was created to give physical form to the American dream of fairness, equality, and order. In effect, an attempt to express the American ideals in the form of a city plan. Philadelphia, from the time Penn's plan was laid out in 1682, was a city of order, far more than Boston or New York. Boston grew up somewhat helter-skelter in the manner of so many early cities. New York started out that way, too, of course, but by early in the 19th century, it had adopted a grid that was envisioned not as a utopian ideal the way William Penn's was, but rather as a simple, direct, and rational way of dividing land and making it, for all intents and purposes, into a commodity. Philadelphia had something else in mind from the start, something far more socially and philosophically ambitious, translating the Quaker dream of fairness, modesty, and reason into a physical plan, and, we might even say, seeking to find common cause between Quakerism and the American aspiration. This was entirely different in its intentions from the business-like grid that would follow more than a century later in New York. Philadelphia's grid was an all-encompassing vision of urban and social order. Surely the placement of City Hall at the grid's absolute center was and is the purest example, the purest and most idealistic and least ambiguous example of civic symbolism of any major city in the United States. As everyone in this room, of course, knows, City Hall is both literally and figuratively Philadelphia's true focus. For generations, it was not only the city's epicenter, but also its tallest building, with Broad and Market streets emanating from it. It represented in physical form the triumph of the concept of the public realm. The notion that the public realm, the civic space, is truly the heart of the city, and therefore more important than the private realm. And then, of course, the four squares, providing smaller scale public spaces in the form of the presence of nature as a break from the grid, standing also as a reminder that the civic ideal of Penn's city plan as a whole could be replicated at smaller scale within individual neighborhoods, as we see, in fact, out the door of this very building. This colonial city that was built on Penn's plan would seem, as I've said, to be very different from the City Beautiful, from the planning and design instincts that brought us not only Benjamin Franklin Parkway itself, but the related changes to Penn's plan that collectively made Philadelphia surely the city with the most overt Parisian aspirations of any American city, or at least the city with the most success at realizing such aspirations, as David Brownlee has told us. Penn's Philadelphia was rational, ordered, modest, a vision of the Quaker ideal. The Philadelphia of Jacques Reber, who laid out the parkway and deserves the most credit for its final design, altered from Paul Cray's original, was vast, sweeping, monumental, bold, and, perhaps this is the most important contrast, emphatically not intimate. Penn's Philadelphia, though it's famous for its squares, was built around streets. The Philadelphia of Benjamin Franklin Parkway is a city of a grand boulevard, better admired from a carriage or an automobile than as a pedestrian. To make it possible, one of Penn's four squares, Logan, had to be turned into Logan Circle, a traffic roundabout surrounded and enclosed by civic buildings that were as direct a replica of the east side of the Place de la Concorde as Horace Trumbauer dared to make them. I must say, the other thing that Philadelphia replicated well from Paris was the traffic. All of this would seem to underscore the notion that there was a disconnect between the city of William Penn and the city of Jacques Reber, Paul Cray, Horace Trumbauer, and others who had been trained in the Beaux-Arts and wanted to bring City Beautiful ideals to Philadelphia. And yet there's another way to view what happened in Philadelphia 100 years ago. And I think in the end it's the more accurate view, which is that the Benjamin Franklin Parkway and everything that came along with it represented a break from Philadelphia only in the most superficial way, in the move from small-scale blocks to large, in the move from a tight grid to a great diagonal boulevard. But beneath these obvious differences, there are some commonalities that may, in the end, be more significant. For underlying the very different appearance of William Penn's small blocks and squares and Paul Cray and Jacques Reber's wide boulevard, there was a shared view that the city can and must be shaped for human betterment, and that physical form is the template on which social action is played out, and that the public realm is preeminent, that it has a position in the hierarchy of the city that puts it above the commercial realm. If that is not as apparent today as it once was, when no building was allowed to be taller than City Hall, the power of the plan of Philadelphia still gives City Hall a pride of place at the city's heart that no commercial tower can usurp from it. However much the Philadelphia skyline now resembles that of other cities. The importance of the public realm is still embodied in the plan, even if it is no longer visible in the sky. Both William Penn's Philadelphia and the Philadelphia of the Benjamin Franklin Parkway were created to elevate the public realm. That is a value that they share. There's another thing that ties Benjamin Franklin Parkway to the history of Philadelphia and makes it feel like a natural part of this city. We should not forget that the École des Beaux-Arts, for all its aspirations to grandeur, was also the product of the French love of things rational, of the French determination to order the universe. Physical order and a willingness to assert it was always a part of the French desire. Look at French gardens and their geometric formality. as compared, say, to English picturesque ones, for example. But this is, to be sure, more than just about gardens. After all, before Le Nôtre, there was Descartes, the Cartesian grid, the belief that the pursuit of the rational is, in a sense, the pursuit of a utopian ideal. And this, too, contributed to the City Beautiful movement. If we think of the City Beautiful designs that emerged out of the principles of the École des Beaux-Arts this way, then they seem even less contradictory to Penn's plan. Penn's vision of Philadelphia in 1682 and the City Beautiful vision represented by the Parkway in 1917 seem allied in a conceptual sense, if not in a formal one. Both were visions of utopia. Both emerged out of a belief in rational geometric order. And both elevated the public realm over the private realm. Let me add one more way in which the Parkway and Penn's original plan for Philadelphia make common cause, and that is in the realm of connection. Benjamin Franklin Parkway is a connector, tying City Hall and the city's heart to Fairmount Park, weaving the two together. Here, too, it is different from many City Beautiful efforts in other cities. San Francisco's City Hall and its surrounding Civic Center, for example, is architecturally appealing, but urbanistically weak, and you never feel that it is doing anything to enhance a sense of connection. It is an island. Benjamin Franklin Parkway, on the other hand, is a river. For all the greatness of the facade of the museum at the far end, and it is one of the great architectural vistas in America, you never have the sense that the buildings on the parkway are more important than the parkway itself. Even the museum and its monumental staircase is in some way subservient to the parkway. The artery and the movement that it symbolizes is the thing. And so it is with Penn's original plan, in which streets are so important, as they are in almost every older city, whether planned or unplanned, that was designed before the automobile did so much to change urban form in the 20th century. I think it's fair to say that in Philadelphia, the City Beautiful manifested itself first in urban form and only secondly in architecture. Whereas in most other cities, it gave us architectural form first and urban form secondly, if at all. I say this not in any way to disrespect the great architectural achievements of Paul Cray, Trumbauer, Clarence Zanziger, and others who built key buildings in the Beaux-Arts style here. It's especially gratifying, of course, that the symposium that begins tonight will look at Cray's extraordinary work in a deeper way. He is, by any measure, one of the major architects of the 20th century, and one of those few remarkable figures in history whose work makes you wonder why we spend so much time debating modernism versus historicism. Since his architecture so eloquently makes the point that reliance on the past and the creative spark of the new are not mutually exclusive by any means. In any event, my point right now is urbanistic, not architectural, and it's one that I suspect that Paul Cray himself would not disagree with. It is that Philadelphia is a city in which a certain larger urban idea has always prevailed, whether it be in William Penn's time or Paul Cray's. While Philadelphia has been home to several of the greatest architects America has produced, Frank Furness, Cray himself, perhaps Trumbauer, surely Louis Kahn and Robert Venturi, it is a city that has not usually put the building ahead of the plan. In Philadelphia's two great and daring leaps of conceptual planning, that of William Penn and that of the Parkway, the city was willing to accept the clear principle that the whole was more than the sum of its parts. From Penn in 1682 to the Parkway more than 2 1/4 centuries later, the principle held. All of that said, there is still plenty to question about the Parkway. It is not perfect. It is certainly not a template for the rest of the city. And we may want to question not only its grandiose scale, which is for the most part inhospitable to pedestrians, and I know today I tried to cross it, but also the way in which it has created a secondary order of cultural institutions away from the central business district. It represents a vision of the city in which culture is viewed as if it were a delicate flower that would be damaged by being mixed in too closely with the rest of the city. Keep it away from the corrupting influence of the city's commercial life and put it in a beautiful park-like setting. That is something the City Beautiful movement tried to do almost everywhere, certainly not only in Philadelphia, but the impact of this particular aspect of City Beautiful thinking was perhaps greater in Philadelphia than anywhere else in the United States. And it meant that the location of this city's cultural institutions that were created or relocated after 1917 was particularly prone to this notion of segregation. The original Academy of Music, of course, was an exception, as was Furness's incomparable Pennsylvania Academy, because both of them predate the City Beautiful preference for cultural segregation. You are lucky for that. I'm not sure that concertgoers in Philadelphia have ever suffered from the way in which either the Academy of Music or the Kimmel Center were closely tied into urban fabric rather than set apart as the later art museums are. Visitors to the Kimmel Center may have suffered for other reasons, but not for location. In any case, as I've said, almost every city did this, and most of them did so in a way that is ultimately less successful than, and less appealing than the Parkway here. Cleveland's University Circle cultural compound is one good example of an island that is not only apart from downtown, but also lacks the sense of connection that the Parkway offers in Philadelphia as proof that the City Beautiful's somewhat naive, not to mention excessive, notions of cultural institutions as being somehow elevated by their separation did not have to result in completely cutting them off. Yes, but. It is a big but, since it is hard not to come back again to the question of scale, which forces us to admit that for all that the Parkway is a connector, its scale is such that it renders the Philadelphia Museum of Art effectively an island anyway. The planner, Alexander Garvin, has referred to it as, and I quote, a monumental axis, green, filled with motor vehicles, but devoid of people. Its symbolic purpose, connecting a palace of the arts with a palace of politics, may have made geometric sense, but had little effect on the daily lives of downtown workers or neighborhood apartment dwellers, and therefore could not stimulate second growth. Now, every planning and design decision a city makes is not necessarily about stimulating growth, of course, but the Parkway does make it imperative for us to question the role of symbols when they do not connect easily and naturally to everyday life. Not for nothing do New Yorkers treat the Brooklyn Bridge, Central Park, the New York Public Library, and Grand Central Terminal with a very special kind of reverence. It is the respect engendered by the buildings that unite symbolic power and everyday life. They are at once majestic works of glory and parts of our daily routines, and every one of them is deeply embedded in the urban fabric. You encounter them as you saunter along, and you engage with them merely by passing them by. You enter and leave them casually, however profound the experience that they offer may be, once you're inside them, or walking along them, as the case may be. None of these things stands apart, and their integration into the larger urban whole in no way compromises their integrity as great monuments. To some extent, that's what the buildings around Logan Circle do. Certainly the Franklin Institute does feel a part of the urban fabric in a way that, say, the buildings farther out along the parkway do not. The view down the parkway toward the Philadelphia Museum is one of the greatest architectural vistas in America. I know I've said that already, but it bears repeating. But its majesty exists at a price, and that price is a sense of remove from urban life. The relationship of the museum to the parkway, and therefore to the rest of the life of the city, is very different from the relationship, say, of the New York Public Library to Fifth Avenue, or for that matter, that of the Franklin Institute to Logan Circle. In the case of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, monumentality implies aloofness. In the case of the other buildings, it does not. Does any of this matter? Or perhaps the better question to ask is this trade-off worth it? Are we getting something wonderful, even extraordinary, in exchange for placing the museum on an architectural and urbanistic pedestal? I think I've already suggested that the answer is yes. Philadelphia has gotten something wonderful, beautiful, inspiring, and even unique in this trade-off. But let us not assume that it is free, that we are not paying a certain price for it. And that, I think, brings us neatly to the question of my title for this talk, which is What the City Beautiful Movement Means for the City of the 21st Century, for the city of today. We're less interested in being awed, although perhaps a little awe in the modern city would do us good. We are certainly less interested in separating cultural facilities and placing them in an elegant assemblage that is disconnected from the ongoing life of the city. That was a specific intention of the City Beautiful movement, which believed it was showing respect both for the idea of the public realm and for the special position of cultural and civic structures. Now, in an age shaped far more by the ideas of Jane Jacobs than by the visions of the École des Beaux-Arts, we are happy to have culture, but more inclined to believe it should be part of a much more diverse, active mix, focused on the street, not in a special and private quarter of its own. That does not mean, however, that City Beautiful ideas are irrelevant or contradictory to all that we now aspire to in the city. If there's anything I've learned in several decades of looking at buildings and cities, it's that in the making of a successful city, the street is more important than the building. You cannot have a great city without great streets. And as I've said, the notion of a coherent whole is critical to the City Beautiful movement, nowhere more so than on Benjamin Franklin Parkway. That the scale of the parkway is not as inviting to pedestrian life as this view of Broad Street we see here is an unfortunate truth, but it does not render the larger vision of the parkway irrelevant to the notion of wholes and coherence, and the idea of the street as a place of connection. Here might be the right moment to quote one of my favorite lines from Louis Kahn: "The street is a room by agreement." If I've applied that line more often to conventional, lively streets like Broad Street as we see here, or Chestnut here, or Walnut, or Madison Avenue in New York, there's no reason why that room by agreement, cannot sometimes be the great hall of a palace, which is what, if we stick with Kahn's metaphor, the Benjamin Franklin Parkway surely is. Every room cannot and should not be the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, and perhaps the real issue that divides the cities of our time from the urban vision of the City Beautiful is the whole question of grandeur and our complicated, somewhat ambivalent relationship to creating it today in the public as opposed to the private realm. A noble public realm was the primary objective of the City Beautiful. And today, when we have not only diminished the public realm, but privatized so large a portion of it, the aspirations of the City Beautiful are useful to think about once more. They force us to confront our age's jaded view of the public realm as something that is either not worth having at all or not worth paying for, which is why we turn so much of it into something private, by which I mean two things. In our age of great income inequality, we have plenty of totally private grandeur, building bigger and bigger houses for those who can afford them. We also create a kind of mock public realm within private real estate developments that includes plazas and atriums and the like, private places to which the public is required to have regular ongoing access, usually in exchange for zoning bonuses, allowing developers to make their private projects even bigger and more profitable than they might otherwise have been. Whether this is a good thing or not, and it's too big a subject for us to tackle tonight, it is hardly the same as places that are truly public. We've become so cynical, so beaten down on this subject, that when there is a genuine attempt to build something for the public realm that aspires to the same high ambitions of the City Beautiful, we are inclined to treat it with disdain, as New York did not long ago with the Oculus, the enormous commuter train station in Lower Manhattan by Santiago Calatrava that was part of the rebuilding effort around the site of the World Trade Center, and which has been widely attacked as needlessly expensive and useless. Now, to be perfectly honest, the Oculus is not my favorite work of architecture, and it was excessively expensive, and it is one part public space, one part shopping mall, but so what? 30th Street Station is part shopping mall too, and I respect the ambitions and intentions of the Oculus, even if I am not totally in love with the result. This is, by any measure, an attempt to create monumental public space for the pleasure of the public, and it is an ennobling act in the spirit of the City Beautiful, however little resemblance it may bear to the classicism of the Beaux-Arts. It is something of a paradox that we bemoan the lack of public expenditure for the public realm today, for better public architecture, that is, and yet when an attempt is made to do something ambitious, we are quicker to complain about how much it costs than to inquire into its long-term value for our society. In an age of ever more measurable data points, an age in which we think constantly in terms of quantifiable metrics, architecture poses a challenge because it defies quantifiable metrics. You cannot measure the impact of the Oculus or Grand Central Terminal or 30th Street Station any more than you can measure the impact of the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. Yes, you could measure how many pedestrians walk the parkway, how many people go through 30th Street Station. And we know at the parkway, that number would be far fewer than we would like. And we know why, because it lacks certain qualities that make streets that are within the denser urban fabric of Philadelphia's center city so attractive. But we cannot measure the impact the parkway has on the quality of life in Philadelphia, on how much better it makes both Philadelphians and visitors feel about this city, about how much of a trade-off there is between the things that we give up to have the parkway and the quality of life improvements that the parkway gives us in exchange. This all brings to mind Oscar Wilde's great comment that a cynic is someone who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. The City Beautiful knew the value of architecture and the public realm, and it did not particularly care about the price. Today, we are more like Wilde's cynic. We care about the price, and we cannot see its value because we think the price is too high. Well, indeed it is if you think only in the short term. Another quality of the City Beautiful that we may well learn from today is that it did not think in the short term at all. The ideas that gave birth to the Benjamin Franklin Parkway were not ideas that spoke to 20-year depreciation and tax benefits. The architects who gave us the parkway and its accompanying institutional buildings were looking at Philadelphia as it would be in 100 years or 200. They would have been pleased, but surely not surprised, that we were gathering here now to mark the centennial of the parkway. Actually, maybe they would have been a bit surprised, because they would have taken it as such a natural thing that they were designing and building for the generations to come, for the centuries to come, that they might have wondered why we were making such a big deal of this first 100 years. There have been two vast changes in how we look at public architecture, at the public realm, since Philadelphia built the parkway and the cultural institutions that are a part of it. One is the one I've just touched on. We tend to think today in terms of metrics, in terms of dollars and prices, and not in terms of long-term value and issues of quality rather than quantity. But there's also a very different factor defining our outlook today, which is that we've been profoundly influenced by the ideas of Jane Jacobs, whose Death and Life of Great American Cities is one of the great books on cities of all time, but one that for all its fundamental wisdom can be interpreted as giving a certain encouragement to the world of short-term, limited, incremental thinking. Jacobs brilliantly showed us the failings of a certain kind of sweeping, overly ambitious, and diagrammatic modernist planning. Indeed, she often said that her ideas crystallized after a visit to Philadelphia in the 1950s, during which she walked around with Edmund Bacon, Philadelphia's great planner and theorist of cities, who showed her what he considered progressive urban renewal, and which she found to be empty and lifeless, especially in contrast with the lively streets nearby, which she pointed out to Bacon, and he responded with disdain, telling Jacobs that he viewed those streets as merely remnants of the old neighborhood he hadn't gotten around yet to fixing. Well, it was inevitable, I suppose, that a lecture about cities in Philadelphia would have to mention Ed Bacon, and we've gotten this far. But now I do need to say something about him, because he is relevant to the argument. Bacon's Design of Cities is a critical book in modernist planning history, and it is a brilliant and insightful one in many ways. But it is all about physical form, all about diagrams, in a sense, or about forms and order and solids and voids, and about crafting balances between these two things. It is wrong not in the specific observations it makes about spaces and solids and scale and proportion and so forth, but in its elevation of these formal gestures over all other things. You could read Bacon and feel that the city is entirely a matter of design, and if you just put the physical pieces together correctly, you have it made. Well, of course not, and I find Bacon's book oddly bloodless in this way, but I do think it's fair to say that the City Beautiful movement operated under the same fallacy. Although its architectural taste was quite different from that of Bacon, it took as a given that if you design well to the right diagram, you have done your job. It either did not recognize or chose not to acknowledge how many other factors must go into the making of a good and workable and pleasing city. Jane Jacobs, helped us understand that the city is, at least in part, an organic living thing with its own ecosystem, both economic and social, that we need to respect, and that we need to respect and work with these things, not against them. Randomness and serendipity can be as important to the success of a city as planning and design. But to Bacon, and perhaps too, to the great architects of the City Beautiful, these organic, naturally occurring qualities were not the friends of a good city, but its enemies. But those virtues of randomness and serendipity are fickle. They're not things we can always count on, and we can never rely on them alone and trust the city to grow and develop well of its own accord. The laissez-faire city may not have the deadening qualities of the overly planned or poorly planned city, but it is its own kind of disaster. Like all living things, cities need care and management. A garden, too, is a natural thing, but leave it to its own devices, and it will be an ungodly mess. So, too, with the city. We need to know how to balance natural growth with management, direction, and care. We have an added challenge today that the architects and designers of an earlier generation did not, and that is the pressure to grow ever bigger and ever larger. You surely understand that in Philadelphia, where now more than a quarter of a century has passed since the rule was lifted that kept all commercial towers lower than the top of City Hall. And the city's skyline has grown to a point where it is now hard to see William Penn's statue any longer. This, of course, throws into a different light much of what Jane Jacobs had to say about not planning too much, about not interfering in the natural process of urban growth, since so much of her work was implicitly, if not explicitly, an advocacy of smaller scale pedestrian-oriented neighborhoods, Greenwich Village most famously, but also so much here in Center City, Philadelphia as well. The casual, easygoing variety of different things in no precise order, but all of them making a complex whole, the difficult, complex whole Robert Venturi wrote of in his great work, Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture, a book that is at least partially a kind of refutation of Edmund Bacon. This confidence that the natural order of things brings us the complex whole that we want may work on streets and in modestly scaled neighborhoods, but it does not work so well in a business district of skyscrapers. It is one thing to put little buildings everywhere, and quite another to put big buildings, huge skyscrapers everywhere, and to celebrate the fact that they are somewhat helter-skelter. Let us not forget that in the pedestrian scale of the walkable neighborhood, the street itself is the template that holds all of it together. The street cannot perform that function at the huge scale of the skyline. But putting big buildings everywhere with no clear plan is what we do today. Either trusting that the randomness that makes small-scale neighborhoods so appealing will work at the scale of 50, 60, 70-story towers, or maybe simply not caring if it doesn't. We are far more aware of street life and its benefits than the Beaux-Arts architects and the modern classicists were. That much we have learned, in part from Jane Jacobs, and that is all to the good. Yet too often, we express the desire for street life in the form of plazas and minor alterations to the ground floors of skyscrapers, privately owned public spaces that we are better off having than not, but which do relatively little to make the streets of which they're a part work as we would hope that they would. The privatization of the public realm is a whole other subject, and as I said earlier, I don't want to digress totally into it, and I'm not sure how much of it is directly relevant to the real question, which is what the modern classicism of the City Beautiful movement means for our cities today. The more compelling question is this: is there a way for its love of beauty and classical order to coexist with our love of urbanity, visual stimulation, variety, and pedestrian life? How do we integrate its order and serenity into the contemporary city that is based on diversity and liveliness? And if we probe beneath that question, how much is the City Beautiful vision of the city compatible with diversity at all? That last one is the easiest one to answer, I think, because it misreads the City Beautiful movement to interpret it and to interpret modern classicism, which I'm showing you by example, leaving Philadelphia to go down the road to a great Paul Cray building in Washington. It misreads the City Beautiful to interpret modern classicism as something elite and excluding. Other speakers over the course of this symposium will look at architecture and questions of style much more carefully in tomorrow's session than I'm able to do here tonight. But let me just say that I don't believe that there's anything inherent in modern classicism, in the City Beautiful, that needs to be incompatible with what we might call our broader social vision of the city today as a more inclusive and socially and economically open and diverse place. If some of the architects of 20th century classicism envisioned their buildings as representative of a different kind of city, as emblematic of a more restrictive kind of social fabric than the one we aspire to today, that's revealing of their limits, not of any limits of the architecture itself. I don't believe there's anything inherently limiting or exclusive to classicism. And indeed, we might go farther and say that its generosity of public space and its belief in the ennobling qualities of monumentality are fundamentally democratic ideas. Now, if classicism has often been associated with power, and modern classicism, given its connections to fascism, particularly so, let us not read more into this association than it deserves. And remember, while the associations we have with buildings and their makers play some role in determining how we experience them, all buildings contain elements that we respond to empathetically and emotionally. The modern classicism of Philadelphia, and particularly for me, that of Paul Cray, is possessed of grace and subtlety, which it expresses far more than power. Now, of course, I've wandered into David Brownlee's turf tomorrow, which is just what I said I would not be doing, but I do think it's important to differentiate between the modern classicism that possesses grace, subtlety, and openness, and seems created to enrich the public realm, and that which seems only to be an assertion of power, or that which seems only tired. And that brings us back, as it should, to the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. Oh, sorry, this is not the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. This is something else altogether. Oops. Oh, well. You know, they always say you should review your slides beforehand, and I always trust it will be okay. All right, there we are. Okay. The Parkway stands for ambition, for vision, for a city that believes that beauty is the right of every citizen. It is not itself a physical model. We would not want an entire city of such broad boulevards and object buildings, even if we were offered it. But its suitability as a model is no way to assess its value. We may not want to imitate it, but we do want to learn its lessons, the most important of which is that Philadelphia is a city that believes in making grand gestures on behalf of its citizens, and believes that monumentality well executed is a gift and a privilege for all. Most important, the Parkway reminds us that Philadelphia believes in the public realm and in the fact that however strong its individual neighborhoods may be, the city benefits from having some things that go beyond these neighborhoods and exist for all. The Parkway reminds us that the city is absolutely, incontrovertibly, and permanently a public place, and that however much the commercial realm may now hold sway over the city's skyline, as it does in almost every other city, the public realm in Philadelphia still commands the ground plane. I can think of no other city in which the importance of the public realm is as beautifully expressed on the ground as here at Benjamin Franklin Parkway. And it makes me think also that it is in the area of public space, perhaps, that the aspirations of the 21st century city truly do intersect with the City Beautiful movement. Back in New York, and now we know why I'm showing, including this, when I look at places like the High Line or the Hudson River Park or Brooklyn Bridge Park, all new, all very new examples of public space being rethought for our time, I think of them not only as new forms of public space design, which they are, of course, but also as a kind of re-energizing of the City Beautiful idea in different form. The essence of that idea is that grandeur, beauty, and even some degree of extravagance should belong to us all, that we should all have the right to have a taste of it, and that public space is an even more important manifestation of our right to public grandeur than buildings. And no place expresses this, the idea that grandeur in the form of public space belongs to all of us, than Benjamin Franklin Parkway. As much Philadelphia's treasure today as when it was created 100 years ago. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.